Not ready for prime time. Warmed over rhetoric and boogeyman stories about foreign influence in the 2020 election. The haunting of America continues. Attorney General nominee Todd Blanche says the Justice Department will investigate any new Jeffrey Epstein lead. New Mexico's Attorney General Raul Torres accuses Blanche of stonewalling a live Epstein investigation right now, and he joins us. New York has imposed a one-year moratorium on data center construction. It's not alone. Aaron Brockovich, yes, the one about whom the blockbuster movie was made, tracks the national movement to regulate data center expansion and tells us why. Hi everyone, I'm Major Garrett in New York. They move me around a lot, you know. Welcome to The Takeout. Foreign influence lurked around the 2016 election, which Donald Trump won. Foreign influence lurked around the 2020 election, which Donald Trump lost. Foreign influence lurked around the 2024 election, which Donald Trump won. You know the election he complains about. Influence means trying to alter perceptions, debate, and information flows around a pending election. It is a decades-old spycraft stratagem, sharpened during the Cold War by America's adversaries and, if we are being honest and we should be, America itself. We used it in other countries that were up for grabs in the relentless Cold War battle for global supremacy. Influence does not mean changing an election outcome, changing or nullifying votes. That has never happened in this country, not once. President Trump may suggest in a primetime address tonight that it happened in 2020. It did not. He may suggest it might have come close to happening in 2020. That would stretch credulity to the point of snapping. Joe Biden won that election by 7 million votes and with 306 electoral votes. If foreign influence is a serious issue, and the president will tell you tonight it is, one would think his administration would bankroll efforts to combat it. President Trump has done precisely the opposite, slashing the budget of the federal agency that helps states repel cyber intrusions, and reducing that agency's workforce by nearly a third. This administration has also abandoned cooperative efforts with states to share best practices and early warning intelligence on bad foreign cyber actors. Rhetoric versus reality. That is the tension today and every day when Trump touts election integrity. The other tension is with the federal courts. Trump keeps trying to increase federal controls over voter rolls, procedures, and other matters. Courts keep denying him on firm constitutional grounds. As we've said before on this program, states oversee elections with broad guidance from Congress, not the president. So we must ask ourselves, is this about something else? Rhetorically a prelude for Trump to, as he has repeatedly said, federalize the upcoming midterm elections? Deploy troops, bring National Guard under federal control, dispatch them to voting precincts, counting centers? That we cannot categorically rule this scenario out tells us where we as a nation find ourselves. Republicans who speak about this matter publicly hope this is not what comes to pass. They are minimally psyched about tonight's address. They would prefer Trump talk about inflation, job growth, Trump accounts, AI, education reform, immigration, even the continuing and unpopular Iran war, anything but rehashed grievances about a long-lost election, the result of which was confirmed via recounts, audits, lawsuits, and certifications. But about all this, Trump is defiant. And defiant would be a high-index tone prediction for tonight's address. With more on that, we turn to Ed O'Keefe at the White House. Ed.
Major, good to see you. Look, CBS News has learned that this speech is expected to reveal previously unreported alleged Chinese meddling in U.S. elections. And multiple sources tell us he's expected to reveal the intelligence community withheld details about Chinese influence operations during his first term. But beyond that, it's not entirely clear what more he might show or suggest regarding future elections and any concerns with them. And I think, as you always do, it's important to reiterate to the viewers, there is no one way to manipulate results across every single voting location across the country because by design in the Constitution, it is a decentralized process controlled by your state and your community. And so the idea that some foreign entity could come into the country and manipulate results in a mass scale is by design not possible and has never happened before. And there's no evidence of any direct interference by foreign entities in American elections ever succeeding. And so we asked throughout the day for more information on what exactly it is he wants to talk about tonight that's any different than what he has focused on for the last 6 or 7 years regarding his concerns with the 2020 election. And the White House essentially does what classic White House press secretary situations with reporters do on days like today when there's a big speech. Tune in tonight, you'll find out. But this exchange with Caroline Leavitt is telling. Take a look.
Concerns about the election. Will the president accept the results of November's elections?
Look, Ed, you should tune into the president's speech tonight before you jump ahead to conclusions about what's actually in the speech. Again, I've seen a lot of reporting and misreporting about what the president will say. We hope CBS will take the speech and all Americans should take it.
There were no presumptions being made by this reporter, simply trying to lay out whether or not the president plans to accept the results of the elections. The vice president was asked that question yesterday, and he said yes, but that doesn't mean we're not going to look into concerns that people have had about potential fraud and make sure that we're doing everything we can to avoid it. It's also part of the president's push to pass what he calls the Save America Act, or this national voter regulation bill that would establish national voter ID and citizenship standards that doesn't currently have the sufficient support to pass and probably wouldn't be able to be implemented in time for this year's elections anyway. That'll be a part of tonight's speech undoubtedly as well, because every time he talks about elections these days, he's trying to compel fellow Republicans to pass something that right now they just can't. So, Major, this is, you know, one of his favorite topics, election integrity, as they call it here at the White House, not one that is necessarily top of mind for most voters in the country, certainly for some, a lot of his supporters, but not for everyone, at a time when there are concerns about the future of the economy, the war with Iran, immigration, and other issues.
Ed O'Keefe at the White House, thank you so very much. So let's talk more about this with CBS News election law expert and contributor David Becker. He is also the executive director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. David, let's work on some terminology here. Meddling, foreign influence, how should we understand what those words actually mean and are meant to convey?
Right. When foreign adversaries seek to perhaps influence American elections, they're going to use tools like disinformation, social media. We've seen this regularly. Our foreign adversaries regularly do this. We generally consider these influence operations. These are very different from interference operations, infiltration exercises, where foreign adversaries might seek to actually get inside election infrastructure, mess with some of the technology that we have. But we rarely see that. In fact, the only time we've really ever seen that was in the 2016 election when Russia attempted to do that. They didn't successfully change anything. The Senate Intelligence Committee, both parties, found that to be true. But what foreign adversaries have discovered is that because of our decentralized elections, because of the security around our systems, because of paper ballots and audits, it is really hard to infiltrate election systems to change an election. But through those influence operations, trying to spread disinformation on social media, that is a low-risk, high-reward proposition, and I think we see that regularly from our foreign adversaries.
And speaking of foreign adversaries, what do we know about China and its various efforts in this space?
Well, all of the information about foreign influence operations in 2020 has already been released. There was a declassified report issued by the intelligence community in March of 2021 that was a declassified version of a classified version of that report with more information in it that was presented to the President of the United States on January 7th, 2021, of all days. That was presented to President Trump, who was in office. He saw all of the classified information. And what that showed is that China, kind of similarly to other adversaries, particularly Iran and Russia, might have attempted influence operations. Specifically in that report with regard to China, a majority of the intelligence community had determined that or thought that China did not even attempt to influence our elections. They didn't really think it was worth it. there was a minority view that they attempted to influence our elections through disinformation, but there was no evidence that anyone in the intelligence community brought forward that indicated they actually interfered with the technology or the election infrastructure in the elections. There was no evidence whatsoever that it altered anything with regard to the vote count or the voting process.
And to David, to expand on that last point you made, is there ever an instance in American history that we are aware of a foreign adversary infiltrating and materially altering the outcome of an election?
Infiltrating, yes. Altering the election, no. Russia did gain access to the Illinois voter registration database in the summer of 2016. It was discovered after about 3 weeks. I believe the Russians wanted to be discovered. They did some things that made it obvious that they were doing this. And Illinois subsequently confirmed that no records had been altered, nothing had changed. Voter data is very secure. There are backups. There are various ways to make sure of that. If a foreign adversary ever did gain access to voting infrastructure, like a voter registration database, we would see that because voters would have problems at the polls. They would be deleted. Their information was changed. We have never seen any of that. If they ever tried to access even one voting machine, which are not connected to the internet, they can't be infiltrated en masse. You can only do it one at a time with physical access. Even then, we would discover it thanks to the paper ballots and audits that every state conducts after an election that confirm by hand that the machine count was accurate.
Very quickly, David, how prepared are we for the midterms?
I think despite all the disinformation, despite some of the attacks from the federal government on state and local election officials, I think we're seeing in the midterms that the states are running, or in their midterm primaries, the states are really well prepared. The elections are going very well despite all of the disinformation, and we're about two-thirds of the way through. We're going to see a lot of primaries coming up in August. I have really high expectations for the quality of this election, thanks to the public servants who run those elections, and I think we might even see record high turnout for a midterm election in November.
David Becker, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Major.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is facing backlash tonight over his decision to fire the country's defense minister. The dismissal is part of a cabinet shakeup that has some Ukrainian officials and those in the streets questioning the timing and the motives. CBS News international reporter Aiden Stretch has more from Kyiv.
You can see some of the reaction here in Kyiv, Ukraine, to President Zelensky's decision to fire Defense Minister Mykhailo Fedorov. Fedorov was extremely popular across the country, and he's credited with a number of crucial Ukrainian battlefield successes in recent months. He took this post in January and soon after negotiated an agreement with Elon Musk that reduced Russia's use of Starlink, the satellite technology, and expanded Ukraine's use of it. And Ukrainian drone pilots have now been able to reach deeper into Russia, targeting places like oil refineries around Moscow, often using Starlink for those strikes. Ukrainian officials say that there are a number of reasons for Fedorov's ouster, but the most important one is that he was chafing with some of Ukraine's top leadership, including Ukraine's commander of the armed forces, Oleksandr Syrsky. But as you can actually hear them saying right now, they're saying, "Syrsky, go away," which is their message to Zelensky that they want Fedorov reinstated. Back to you.
If past is prologue, the World Cup will come to a dramatic and electrifying close on Sunday when Argentina and Spain face off in the final. The tournament has not only been thrilling for soccer fans, even the nominal soccer fans, it's been an economic boom for host cities across the United States and also in Canada and Mexico. CBS News Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent and Face the Nation moderator Margaret Brennan joins me now. Margaret recently spoke with the head of Bank of America, which is a pretty prominent and visible sponsor of the World Cup. So what has the economic impact been?
Well, Major, according to Bank of America, they estimate a $20 billion boost to the U.S. economy, more than that on a global basis, because, of course, these are the games not just on U.S. soil. But when you look at American cities like Kansas City, whether it's Boston, whether it's out in L.A., or the finals on Sunday in the New York, New Jersey area, of course, there's more spending, not just on the grounds, but to local restaurants, to bars. And all of that together is a boost, along with those tuning in globally. About 2 billion people are expected to watch on Sunday for the final. So it is obviously a huge marketing opportunity, as well as you just mentioned, for Bank of America. And they made the largest sports investment in that bank's history in order to have their name associated with FIFA. They inked that deal back in 2024. So we are seeing that Americans are still spending when it comes to some escapism. Listen to the CEO, Brian Moynihan.
Our team did a research piece, Margaret, that said that the total amount that is economically generated around FIFA is about $40 billion, $20 billion would be in the U.S. And then even we look in the host cities like a Kansas City, we can see the growth rate in spending faster than other cities. So it's having this on-the-ground economic impact. And that spending is going into what we call bricks and mortar. It's going to bars and restaurants and things like that.
So, Major, that's a bright spot in an economy where we're constantly talking about Americans feeling bad about how, you know, they want to pay money at the grocery store for higher food prices, the like. They're still spending to go, I guess, disassociate, entertain themselves.
Right. There's all this gloomy polling data, but we keep hearing this from banks and others in the financial sector that the American consumer and consumerism writ large remains resilient. Bank of America seeing that, I guess.
Yes, and we will say there is a caveat there. You know, you often hear this reference to the K-shaped economy. That is to say that people at the mid-income and the higher income brackets are really fueling a lot of the spending and the growth. Lower income, that may sound logical, but they are those who are feeling the restriction in their ability to spend on things like entertainment because they are paying more, for example, on food and gas. You know, gas prices are up 31% since this war in Iran began, and they aren't really expected to go lower because fuel inventories are still on the short end. So it's a different economy based on where you fall in those brackets, but Americans are still spending when it comes to trying to enjoy themselves.
Did Brian Moynihan have any other notes on the economy, Margaret?
Well, you know, Major, we talk about the stock market really going gangbusters and looking divorced from those who are worried right now. Bank of America also trying to get in on that IPO boom for artificial intelligence. He acknowledged on the consumer impact, and remember, it was the governor of New York who just said she wants to ban building big data centers in that state, the first to do so. There are worries that, you know, the AI boom could drive up energy prices, drive up resource prices. He says, yeah, sure, short term, it's inflationary. On the other side, it is the future of the economy for jobs, but also, obviously, of great benefit to Wall Street. And he does believe that it is going to continue to be a booming tech space. It's not just that bank. J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon said, things are getting as close to as good as it gets. We just don't know how long this lasts.
It's also been a boom year for banks. Margaret Brennan, thank you so very much. You can see more of Margaret Brennan's interview with Brian Moynihan on Face the Nation this Sunday at 10:30 a.m. Eastern on CBS. Coming up, what an Epstein survivor had to say about Todd Blanche's role in the release, partial release, we should underscore, of the Epstein files. Plus, New York's pause on new data centers is now in effect. We'll speak with environmental activist Aaron Brockovich about the ramifications. And John Fetterman, senator from Pennsylvania, says there's a scenario where he might leave the Democratic Party. That's not what he said on our show last week. Our political panel will discuss. The Takeout returns in 90 seconds. Welcome back to The Takeout, coming to you from New York. Today is the second day of Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche's confirmation hearing. He cannot lose a single Republican vote on the Judiciary Committee and have his nomination move from that committee to a full Senate vote. It can get to the Senate in other ways, but that would be kind of a big deal. Blanche has long faced criticism about his handling, and some would say mishandling, of the Epstein files. He's meeting with survivors today. That's happening, we believe, right about now. Epstein's survivor, Danielle Bensky, testified today why she thinks Blanche should not become the nation's next attorney general. Listen.
Todd Blanche has been unwilling to protect Epstein survivors' personal information. And he has been resistant to investigate the people who helped Epstein and Maxwell commit those crimes. We need an attorney general committed to ensuring that everyone who facilitated Epstein's crimes is held accountable.
Joining me now, New Mexico Attorney General Raul Torres. He is currently in a standoff with the Department of Justice over its failure to release unredacted versions of the Epstein files the attorney general is seeking in a matter very much a part of the New Mexico story with Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. Mm-hmm. Mr. Attorney General, I'm glad to have you here. I want to play another soundbite from Danielle Bensky about what The release of the Epstein files in an unredacted way did to her and other victims by releasing information that made them more vulnerable than they already were. Please listen.
Todd Blanche has been at the helm of the release of nude images of survivors, the outing of Jane Doe's, and the exposure of more than 100 victims identifying information and documents describing horrific acts of abuse, including my own. Instead of treating this release as its own violation and holding the man who led it accountable, you have a decision on whether you place him in the highest law enforcement position in this country.
Mr. Attorney General, when the Department of Justice put out a statement today saying they would try to have a meeting between Todd Blanche and survivors, it said this: "And we have always encouraged any victim with new evidence of a crime to speak with the FBI." Mr. Attorney General, I'm not an expert, but that seems to put the burden on survivors and victims, not on the investigatory apparatus of the federal government.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's unfortunately part of a pattern where there really has not been enough respect and consideration for the dignity of victims. I've had the opportunity to meet with some of them, to talk to them about our investigation in New Mexico. And one of the commitments that we've made is to try and make sure that no matter the outcome of that investigation, we will listen to them, we will talk to them, and we will meet them where they are. We will put in the time and the effort and the energy to go and find them, which is exactly why we've been asking for access to the unredacted and the complete universe of the Epstein files.
What do you want, and what are you not getting yet from the Justice Department? What is it about?
Yeah, so 152 days ago, we asked Todd Blanche and the Justice Department for access to the complete Epstein files, unredacted. And the reason for that is that there have been, based on the open source records, nearly 14,000 references to Zorro Ranch, that's the property in New Mexico. And yet throughout the files that we can see through that are publicly available, a lot of those documents are redacted. So names of individuals.
Blacked out.
That's right. Either blacked out in whole or in part. And so what we believe is that there are opportunities to follow new leads, identify potential co-conspirators, witnesses who have not come forward and testified, given us information, a whole range of information that could help advance our criminal investigation. And unfortunately, the Justice Department, specifically the Southern District of New York, told us just 2 days ago that they wouldn't cooperate with that request and they wouldn't be providing that access.
Todd Blanche could solve this, could he not?
That's exactly right. He can solve this with the stroke of a pen. And we, frankly, have been given the runaround. First, we were told to go back to the District of New Mexico, submit a TUI request. We did that. What they returned to us were 31 pages of publicly available information, news clippings.
Non-responsive.
Things that don't help us move this investigation down the road. And then to hear from the Southern District that we wouldn't be getting access. So we have set a deadline for the end of the month. We will consider a continued lack of cooperation as a denial of that request, and then we'll take further legal steps if we have to do that.
Do you believe you would have standing under the Epstein law to sue the federal government over this?
Well, we have an opportunity to litigate this potentially under, different violations of their own policies and regulations. My hope is that we won't have to get to that. Now, one of the encouraging things that happened yesterday that didn't get a lot of coverage was the introduction by Representative Massey of amendments to the Epstein Act, the Transparency Act, that would give us not only clear and unequivocal access to those files, but an opportunity to file an action in court to vindicate those rights. It also gives new rights to survivors.
Before I let you go, Mr. Attorney General, because I think this is really important, what can you say about what you're hoping to get to? Because it's been a long time.
Yeah.
Zorro Ranch is in another person's possession now. Yeah. Evidence could have gone away. Are you trying to get to truth, or are you trying to find something that, with that truth, can lead to a prosecution?
We're trying to get to both. We're trying to get to truth, and we are trying to give a full accounting of what happened in New Mexico, but we have not ruled out the possibility of prosecutions. We have not ruled out the possibility of still being able to identify individuals who have not yet been held to account for their activity in the state of New Mexico. That's why we need access to these files.
New Mexico Attorney General Raul Torres, I appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you
so much for coming in. New Homeland Security policy could scare green card applicants away from health care, food, and housing assistance. they would be legally eligible to obtain. We'll explain what that means next. You're watching The Takeoff. New York City. Yep, that's where we're coming from. Welcome back to The Takeout. Here's a look at what else we and now you are watching this evening. CBS News has learned the Trump administration is planning to allow immigration officers to weigh whether green card applicants have used taxpayer-funded benefits like Medicaid to determine if they qualify for permanent legal status. This change would impact hundreds of thousands of people who apply for green cards inside the U.S. each year. Critics say it could cause immigrant families to avoid health care, food, and housing assistance they're legally qualified to accept because they would fear it might hurt their future immigration status or cases. President Trump's teleprompter operator is on leave. Listen to this. Is on leave after he allegedly made nearly $100,000 betting on Trump's speeches. Gabriel Perez is said to have used Kalshi to bet on whether Trump would say certain words and phrases during prominent speeches, like the State of the Union address. A source tells CBS News Perez has been cooperating with federal officials on a potential settlement. Press Secretary Caroline Levitt says Trump views this as, quote, unfortunate and a, quote, disgrace. New York is now the first state to temporarily ban data centers, and other jurisdictions may follow suit. Governor Kathy Hochul signed an executive order that pauses construction on new facilities for 1 year to create a framework to protect residents and the environment. Critics say the centers harm the environment and also drive up utility costs. President Trump, though, is calling on Hochul to reverse the order. He says data centers are big, strong, bold, and money machines for the state in which they are built. Environmental advocate Erin Brockovich is here to respond. She uncovered a toxic water scandal many decades ago that inspired a movie starring Julia Roberts. She now runs a website called BrockovichDataCenter.com. Erin, it's a great pleasure to have you on the program. I've watched other interviews, and you have identified this not so much as a Luddite, no data centers ever, stop the whole revolution of AI, but there needs to be less secrecy, more transparency, and more community involvement. Do I have that about right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, not everybody likes AI, but AI is here to stay. That genie's left the bottle, but what this issue is about is the data centers that are being built to feed AI, and they're cropping up all over the United States. I created a map thinking this was happening in one town. I didn't realize it was happening in every single state. And what's been interesting to watch as it unfolds is everybody's having the same concern. This was done almost in secrecy, non-disclosure. They had no idea it was coming. They had no information about how much water consumption was going to be used, you know, who was going to pay for this, what would happen to our utility bills, our water bills, our land, our wildlife, our sanctuary, just, I mean, everything at once. And all of our human resources seem to be getting sucked up in building the data centers out. And that's been everyone's huge concern. And it's just, we're seeing more and more of it as it goes from proposal stage to construction stage to ones that are up and running. People are now reporting very large increases in their electric bill, large increases in their water bill. The noise of these facilities 24/7 is just deafening and maddening. And this is coming from the people who are living and breathing and experiencing what's happening when these very large data centers are built in their own backyard.
And Erin, it's not universally true, but as I understand it, in some states and some localities, all the conversations were completely private, and suddenly the construction would begin and the data center would become a reality. And anyone who was knocking on the door or trying to pick up a phone or texting a member of the city council, the county commission, or the state legislature basically got the Heisman, like, back off. And until this political uprising became more visible, nobody was really minding their central concerns.
Absolutely. And that same process happened for me. I got 30 emails from the same town about data centers. And I'm like, what are these data centers? Let me look into that. And I wanted to see the bigger picture. And we found that out pretty quickly. And what's very interesting, across the board in every single state, Everyone's reporting the exact same thing. We did not know. And then when we are getting notice of it, they set meetings at 9 a.m. when everybody's at work. They set meetings at 3 in the afternoon when everybody's at work. Or if they show up, they're only allowed to speak for 30 minutes. So as you see this kind of popping up everywhere around the U.S., more and more people are starting to show up at their own city councils, and the exact same things are occurring.
And total Aaron, secrecy. As I understand it also,
the stealth bomber came in the night.
It's bipartisan. This is not a right issue or a left issue exclusively.
No, in 30 years of my work, I have never seen a situation like this where it was bipartisan. Both sides of the aisle. There's a lot at stake here. I mean, we were just having a conversation earlier with a community member who's in some litigation over a data center. But by the time it's built, it's projected to be using 7 million gallons of water per day. You add that up over a year, and if several facilities across the country are doing that, we're talking billions and billions of gallons of water usage and water consumption. And who's going to pay the price for all of this? The people are. They're already reporting these huge utility increases, water increases. And so I've just never seen anything as consistent across the country where everybody's reporting the exact same thing, the exact same concerns. And all of it was done in secrecy. They didn't even get a seat at the table to make a vote or have a choice.
It's a conversation we're going to continue to follow. Aaron Brockovich, I appreciate your time. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
It's rare when the Trump administration admits a mistake, but Vice President J.D. Vance did that. On Joe Rogan's podcast, The Unforced Error, he said the administration made over Epstein and the files. That's next here on The Takeout.
Sometimes it feels like the news is full of things that have never happened before, and that is not exactly true. In fact, it may have happened this very week, hundreds or thousands of years ago. I'm Sally Helm, host of the podcast History This Week from the History Channel. Trade embargoes? Thomas Jefferson tried them. Rent too high? We've been arguing about that for a while. Each episode is proof. The past isn't that far away. Listen to History This Week, available now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Tech. You know I love it. What is that? It's political panel time. Republican strategist, former New York State Representative Joe Borelli, Democratic strategist and former senior spokesperson for the Biden transition team, Cameron French. All right. J.D. Vance, the vice president, sat down with Joe Rogan for 3 hours. We played one soundbite yesterday. We're going to play two tonight. The first on the Epstein files and a mistake. Play it.
If people want to say we mishandled the Epstein release, guilty. We did mishandle, especially the communications of it.
What do you think should have been done?
I think that we should have just dropped everything at the very beginning. And like, obviously it takes a little time to review the stuff, to find the stuff, to redact things where you have victims and so forth. But we should have just done it as quickly as possible.
Related, the vice president called himself an Epstein conspiracy theorist. His words, not mine. And then said this.
Well, most people think he was Mossad.
Yeah, Mossad or CIA or some other deep state, whether in America or Israel or another country.
Or both.
You know, look, he clearly had connections to the highest levels of American intelligence. He clearly had connections to the highest levels of Israeli intelligence.
Clearly had connections to the highest levels of Israeli intelligence and American intelligence. That's not been disclosed, or that has been rumored about. It has been sort of on the fringy edge of the Epstein matter for quite some many years. But now the vice president is giving it on Joe Rogan, the absolute administration imprimatur. Joe.
Look, let's start here. This is why people like Joe Rogan to begin with. He gets these very famous people to commit to 2.5-3 hour podcasts, and there's no script. You can't possibly, you know,
talking point your way through 3 hours.
There's no sound bites in 3 hours. It's just raw, unscripted, what people are really thinking. And here you have a situation where the vice president was riffing, and he might have let out some information that was pretty.
He might want to try to claw that back.
Yeah, but look. I like the part where he took responsibility for failing the comms portion of the Epstein file release. They released 3.5 million files. The point was transparency. To have the former attorney general out there saying there's a client list on her desk when that clearly wasn't the truth, right, that just undermines the whole purpose of bringing these files to light. That was their first mistake. Might not be their only mistake, but that was their first mistake.
Cameron?
I mean, look, this was comms 101. It's very basic. As a communicator, if you make a mistake, you own it and you move past it, and people still have trust in the process. The problem is it's too little too late and people have lost trust.
And there's still files that haven't released and unredacted.
Absolutely. And it's too hard to come back from that. If you build credibility from the beginning, it's much easier. They've already lost that credibility. Very difficult to gain it back.
So there is a whole prediction market conversation going on in America that was given new vitality, I believe, today via the Trump White House. A teleprompter operator for the president, we talked about this earlier, allegedly made $100,000 on Kalshi, knowing what the president was going to say because he's running the teleprompter, and now he's in some settlement talk. I mean, this is amazing. Joe.
This is why the industry needs regulation. Look, this was a teleprompter guy, right? Yeah. The last time this happened, it was like a special forces, you know, soldier
right.
who was saying that Maduro was going to be removed. That's a bigger security risk than the teleprompter guy. But fundamentally, this is why these prediction markets really are, you know, sort of the wild west of betting, where people can have this inside intelligence. There's no way to regulate it. There's no self-policing by the sports.
And there's no way for
leagues.
Someone who's also in that prediction market who thinks it's on the up and up to know that this guy scroll through the prompter.
It's thievery because it is based on how much people are betting on each side. So it is theft.
Cameron?
Absolutely. I mean, look, this needs to be stopped. Clear agreement here. We've got to get a handle on this. This is ethically wrong from top to bottom. It needs to get fixed as quickly as possible. And the fact that it's allowed to go on this long without any intervention from Congress or the administration is a problem that we need to really get a handle
on. We highlighted this on the program because it was breaking in the moment when we talked about it. House vote yesterday to deny Israel aid from the United States. About 100 House Democrats voted on it, split the House Democratic leadership. Didn't pass. After that, John Fetterman, Democrat from Pennsylvania, said, if our party ever becomes and just makes it official, the anti-Israel party, that's when I would leave, because that's been a moral clarity for me. This is what I asked John Fetterman last week on my program in the context of Graham Plattner and whether he would ever switch parties, leave the Democratic Party. Play it.
I would never change my party. And, you know, if a Democrat's angry that I'm going to call trash, you know, trash, and if it happens to be a Democrat, yeah, that's trash. And that's entirely what Graham Plattner is, trash.
I would leave. I would never leave. Cameron?
Well, I'm not a spokesperson for Senator Fetterman. But
comms number one.
Comms number one. But on behalf of the senator from my home state, I mean, listen, I think he's going through the same thing that many of us are dealing with as well, which is the evolution of our nation's relationship with Israel as an ally. I have no doubt that John Fetterman will remain a Democrat for many, many years to come. There is space for him in the party, and there has been for years, and people like him. We are not driven by one cult. We are not a personality of one cult, which is what you see on the Republican side. And so there's space for him to be there. There's space for him to have his ideas, and there's space for others to be a part of that party as well. And so the other part of his remarks and his conversation made very clear he would be a terrible Republican because he's going to vote with Democrats all the time.
Joe, the House vote yesterday, again, didn't pass, but it did show a division, not only in the rank and file, but in House Democratic leadership.
Look, you know, and we saw this play out with the socialist revolution of candidates here in New York that ended up winning. You know, there's not much difference between some of these, Brad Lander and existing Congressman Dan Goldman. There was not any delta between their policy positions except for the big issue of Israel. And you saw that replicated with Chevalier and others, where the main differentiating point between the candidates was their support for Israel. So this is a problem
for Democrats. And how much they're willing to support and rhetorically back the Palestinian cause.
Sure. So this is a problem for Democrats going forward because it does drive a big wedge.
Joe Borelli, Cameron French, I appreciate you coming in. Thanks so much. Absolutely. Texas Senator John Cornyn wants to keep Texas an open primary state. Next, I'm joined by an election reform advocate who wants primaries everywhere to be that way. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn is urging his state to keep its open primary system. Some Republicans there want to close that primary. And that's a move that's going on in other jurisdictions as well. What that does is it means independents cannot participate. Earlier this week, I spoke with John Opdyke, who's the head of a group called Open Primaries, about why he's in favor of a more inclusive political system. Here's some of our conversation. Political journalism, super excited about the upcoming midterms, but there's a dirty little secret. 90% of them are over, right?
Yeah.
Tell me why.
Well, right now, most congressional districts have been gerrymandered out of competitive existence. I mean, you know, we've seen this from Texas to California, all over the country. So the
plenty were gerrymandered before that. This just added to
it. It just in some ways cemented it completely. So now you have a situation in which 90 to 93% of members of Congress have one real election, and that's their primary. And unfortunately, the rules of primaries are, A, they shut out independent voters in roughly
20
states.
They're partisan primaries, by definition.
Not all of them.
Not
California,
all of them.
Nebraska.
Not all of them, right. But the ones that are closed are.
Right, exactly. By definition, it has to be partisan to be closed. Other states that are open, the public hasn't yet caught up with the fact that these primaries are where all the decisions are made. So, look, all of us have been educated and the real election is in November.
Right.
That's almost like as American as apple pie. And yet, those November elections are an afterthought. Most members of Congress are on a beach in the Dominican Republic.
Right. Either literally or figuratively.
Literally or figuratively, because they're so uncompetitive. So there's a real movement, and this is a huge
task. A movement
task.
To do what?
Two things. Change the rules. Let every American vote in every election, period. The primary is government funded, government administered. Everybody should be able to vote in it. If the parties want to have private caucuses, conventions, primaries.
To nominate someone or to figure out who the person they're putting up is.
Do it on your own dime and your own time. These are public elections, these primaries.
So let the public participate.
Everybody should be able to vote. But that's only step one. We have to change the culture. We have to educate and convince Americans that voting in primaries is not just something for the super partisan, for the hyper partisan.
Because the culture right now is...
Wait till November.
Right.
Wait till November. But the decisions have all been made in November.
Most of them.
Yeah. I mean, there's probably 30 congressional districts that'll be in play. And obviously presidential elections and Senate races statewide are still in play. The level of competition hasn't gone to zero, but...
And John, I've heard you give lots of interviews, and I want you to help my audience with this, because they're going to hear you and say, oh, wow, well, if John got his way, then everything would change instantly. And what you have said on previous interviews is, no, it would not change instantly. Don't think this is going to unlock whatever your frustrations are with contemporary American politics.
Yes.
Why?
Well, first of all, there's a myth about independent voters. People think they're moderates. People think they're in the middle. People think they're kind of this. They're not. They're as ideologically diverse as the country. They're libertarian, socialist, moderate, liberal, conservative, and everything in between. What they are is people saying, there has to be a better way than this scorched earth. Demonize your opponent.
The other myth is that they're sort of a gelatinous blob of indifference.
Yes, that they're fence sitters. They don't care. No, independence... There's research coming out of Arizona State University. Independents actually have much different social media networks than Democrats and Republicans. They want Democrats, Republicans, liberals, and conservatives, socialists, and libertarians in their orbit. They want to keep an open mind about things.
And they live in a marketplace of ideas.
Right. Independents are much more...
Whereas partisans typically, right now, siloed as they are, do not.
Exactly. So
that's why the parties don't want them in.
Right. They're hard to campaign to. You can't just say Trump is bad and get their vote, or Democrats are socialist communists and get their vote. You actually have to educate, engage, listen. And the candidates in the parties don't really want to do that. They'd much rather have a easy way to stoke fear in order to win. The other thing. So when you open the primaries and you let independents in, people sometimes say, oh, great, now all these moderates will get elected. No, maybe.
Maybe.
But also, here's what we found, is that there have been a number of states that have opened their primaries, and no one told independents. So turnout didn't go up. Mm-hmm. No one informed them, government or private. So now what's happening, we just passed open primaries in New Mexico, and we were part of a campaign to organize independent voters to record PSAs.
Public service
announcement. Yeah, saying, hey, we did it. It took us 10 years. We had to fight tooth and nail. We went to court. We went to the legislature. We finally won the right to vote.
You can listen to more of my conversation with John Updike on your favorite podcast platform. Happy Thursday, everyone, coming to you from New York. Wherever we are The Takeout, relentlessly curious, reliably civil, occasionally clever. The Daily Report is coming up next.
Where are you sending us?
Well, this is a fun one.
On July 23rd, boldly go one step closer to where it all began.
What we are about to do cannot be taken back.
Stream the new season of Star Trek: Strange New Worlds, July 23rd on Paramount+.